that time. It was like, I felt like we were holding this terrible suitcase of grief, like 1,000 pounds of it, lugging it. And when somebody comes to you and they can also hold it with you, it's like, it's not that you're comforted, because it's true, like, only God can send you comfort. But there's a lightening, like, you're not alone.
Shalom from Jerusalem, and welcome to Season 3 of the Koren Podcast.
We're back in a new year with a new season, recording in our brand new offices in the heart of Jerusalem. This year also marks the 60th anniversary of the first ever Koren Tanakh, and big things are happening that we can't wait for you to see.
Yes, and Season 3 of the Koren Podcast is just one of those things, and it's set to be our best season yet. We've got some amazing guests lined up. We've been recording in person for the first time. We've been doing some live shows. It really is amazing. We already have well over 100,000 listeners, but there are so many more people who have yet to learn about the number one Jewish podcast. So when you're done listening, make sure to subscribe, like, rate, review, all those things so that more people can listen to your favorite podcast.
And before we jump into this week's episode, we are sponsored. We've been sponsored this week by The Web Yeshiva. Join Rabbi Chaim Bravender and other world-class Torah teachers at webyeshiva.org. You can sign up for their free, live, and fully interactive online courses and classes, or apply to the Advanced Halacha Mastery Program for men and women. You can choose from over 20 hours of interactive weekly shiurim in Tanakh, Gemara, Halacha, Jewish thought, and more, taught by their amazing teachers, or access thousands of hours of archived courses. webyeshiva.org continues the decades-long work by Rabbi Bravender as a pioneer of Torah learning for everyone, everywhere. So visit webyeshiva.org today, log in and learn.
So on this week's episode, we were incredibly lucky to be invited into the home of our first guest this season, Sherry Mandel. Sherry is a writer and author of two books from the Toby Press, The Blessing of a Broken Heart and The Road to Resilience. We met with her at home in Tekoa to talk about all the amazing things she has done to help grieving people and grieving families all over the world, all as a response to the unspeakable murder of her son, Kobe, 20 years ago.
Yes, I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with Kobe Mandel and a lot of the work that Sherry and her husband Seth have dedicated themselves to, but we got the chance to sit down with Sherry and talk about her life before and after losing her son, how she continues in spite of the grief and the things she's learned along the way.
So, Season 3, Episode 1, let's go.
Shalom from Tekoa. We have been very graciously invited into the home of our guest this week, Sherry Mandel. Sherry is an author, a writer, a teacher, and we're very excited to be talking to her today for this episode of the Koren Podcast about herself, her life, her books, her writing, and we'll see where the discussion takes us. So Sherry, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks so much, Sherry, for having us. Just to start off, can you just tell us a bit about who you are, your story?
Okay, well, we moved to Tekoa 23 years ago. We made Aliyah with four little kids in 1996. And in 2001, my oldest son, Kobe, he was in eighth grade. He and his friend, Yosef Ishran, they decided to cut school. And they went hiking in the wadi here in the canyon nearby. And they never came home. It was during the Intifada, and they were murdered. And they were beaten to death with rocks. So that's part of my story. I mean, there's the before, and then there's the after, but there's also the before I got to Israel, because I grew up totally non-religious, totally non-Zionist. I had no connection to Judaism. I worked in the synagogue. That was like when I was 14. And we wore red velvet hot pants. You probably don't know what hot pants are. It's like short shorts. And like that was my connection to Judaism. So eventually I traveled, and I traveled to Israel. And when I got here, I realized, wow, this is a really interesting place. This isn't the Judaism of America. This is a different idea of being Jewish. And I was kind of captivated by it.
And then, so what happens then, after that upbringing, and you discover Israel for the first time, then what's the final push that brings you to move here in 1996?
Well, first, I got married here in 1985 because I met my husband. And I was learning on I went to study on Leave Not Lehiba Not, which is in Sfat, which is a study program. And I learned about Judaism. I thought, wow, this is really cool, but I'm not doing any of this stuff. Like, I'm not keeping kosher. None of that stuff spoke to me at all. And then I met my husband, and he said basically to get married, he wanted me to, you know, be more religious. And I went to yeshiva, like a midrasha, and I decided to go along with what he wanted. But it was a very hard struggle for me because I loved Judaism. Like, I loved parts of it, like the family part and Shabbos, but parts of Shabbos I liked, like the idea of Shabbat I liked. But when I went into a 3-day holiday with Seth after we were married, it was like I couldn't take it. It was just, it just overwhelmed me. And finally, I just started flashing the lights on and off. I was like a rebellious child.
Right.
So what was the question? What kept me here?
What was it that brought you in 1996 when you made that eventual decision to come to move here?
No, so I had met Seth here and Kobe was born here. Kobe and Daniel, our first two children, were born here. So then we moved back to America for 7 years. And I didn't want to come back to Israel. And my husband had a sabbatical. But before the sabbatical, he quit his job, like three weeks before we were moving, and he didn't tell me. And we ended up coming, and then I was like, I'm not going back to America. I'm staying here.
Right.
But I think, you know, there's something about Israel that is just very interesting and intriguing and exciting. And also, I love the people here. I mean, I love my family and friends in America, too. But, it wasn't easy to come then. It wasn't like, oh, great. I mean, I really didn't want to come either, when we came back.
Yeah, right.
It was very difficult. Just changing countries with four little children and not having a place to live. We didn't get housing. So it was all very difficult.
Right. I imagine our experiences were significantly easier. As we both came in the last 10 years.
Right.
Also with families, but...
No, but you had nefesh b'nefesh, and you had, like, support probably from your families.
Yeah, right.
We had no support. Our families did not want us to be here. And there was very little financial support from Israel, and it was sort of like you just dropped in this country and, you know, do the best you can.
Right. And we don't want to dwell too much on certain aspects of your story, but... You know, you've written the two books, A Blessing of a Broken Heart and The Road to Resilience. What was it that made you decide that you wanted to sit down and write those books? Are they come at different times as well in your life? What was the decision process to sort of put pen to paper?
I think what we're trying to get an idea of is what was it, as in when Blessing of a Broken Heart was, I think, I remember... Again, what year did it come out?
2003.
As in, I was 16 years old in England, and I remember when the book came out. Like,
oh wow!
As I'm saying, like it was significant. It reached far and wide, and it's interesting to hear like what was it that made you.
First of all, I'm a writer, so I'm always writing. But after Kobe was killed, I mean, I wanted to die. I really felt like I just can't. I can't continue life. And there were so many stories that we told at the Shiva about Kobe. And then during that year, so many things happened to us that I just felt like I had to write the story because a lot of the events seemed to me like a spiritual mystery. And the only way I could understand or try to grapple with this horrible murder was to try to write about the things that were happening that year because we had a lot of experiences with birds, for example. A lot of Kobe's death, you know, I started as a poet. So it was just filled with imagery. Everything in this story was almost like biblical imagery, like the cave, that Kobe was murdered in a cave 2 days before Lag BaOmer.
Yeah.
And I was learning about Lag BaOmer like the night before he was killed. And then the whole idea of Shimon Bar Yochai, and that Shimon Bar Yochai lived in a cave. And the rabbi here always claimed that Shimon Bar Yochai lived in a cave here, even though very few people agree with that. And then all these episodes with birds, where birds would crash into my head, or birds would fall at my feet when I was walking in Jerusalem. A bird got caught on the windshield of my car, and I didn't understand what was going on. And then I had a dream, and I said, one of my dreams, and I spoke to God, and I said to God, how can you say that you're a God of kindness? And God answered me, and God said, I am. I do the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKen, of sending away the baby bird, sending away the mother bird, sorry, before you take the baby bird. And then I went and learned with friends about this mitzvah. And what I discovered was that there's this concept of the supernal bird's nest that's like the highest place in the world. And they say that in that supernal bird's nest, that's where Mashiach waits to redeem the world. And in that bird's nest are pictures of the first and second temple and pictures of all the children who died Kiddush Hashem, all the children who died sanctifying God's name. So as I was experiencing and learning, I felt like I had to make a narrative out of it, because a narrative means that you're finding meaning. And even though, of course, like one of the things that they said to us is like, you can't ask lama, you can't ask why, you can only say lema, for what. Like I knew I would never understand, but I felt like God was sending me signs. And even though I was so not a signs and wonder type, I mean, I went to Cornell, I started out in science. I just was not like mystical, or it just wasn't my way. But I felt like I was getting these kind of messages from God, and that I needed to understand them. I needed to decipher them, and I needed to write about it. And, you know, and ultimately I needed to share it.
Can I ask you about, in terms of your relationship with God, obviously, and you talk about that conversation you had with God, was an important part of your journey at that time. I think in almost a cliche way, we hear, you know, people who go through challenging times and they say, that's it, I'm out, like I don't believe in God anymore. And to what extent did you find that actually, no, it was that belief in God that helped you build that, help kind of build that narrative that helped you make things make sense?
No, I felt like God was like almost speaking to me and saying, this is part of a bigger story. And I'm going to be with you because I'm connecting to you. You know, I didn't know if it was God or Kobe, and that might be heretical, but it was like something was happening that was almost supernatural. So I felt like it was from God. And also, I felt like the life I had had before wasn't sufficient. Like the me wasn't big enough to contain this. So I had to become like a bigger me. That's part of what I talk about in the book on resilience. But also language changed for me, because regular language after Kobe was murdered was just unbearable. The thing, you know, ordinary language. And so I needed like elevated language. So the language of prayer spoke to me in a way it never had, because it just, it had a purity, you know, it had a holiness. And I felt like I was connected to the next world. You know, that's part of why it's so hard to parent after a tragedy. It's not just the brokenness. It's that I really wanted to be in that other world, and I felt like I was connecting to that other world. So the world of prayer also connected me to that. And then I had somebody, a friend here who's Israeli, who came and learned Tehillim with me. She learned Psalms with me. And when we learned Psalms, I felt like this is my story. You know, this kind of these terrible, this terrible yearning and tragedy and brokenness of like King David, that was also what we were feeling. So it was like language that was big enough to hold what we were going through. So in a way, it was like, I felt like I was almost pushed into Emunah because I didn't grow up religious. I didn't have a strong feeling for God. Like, I liked Judaism, but God was not so much in the picture. And I felt like God was saying, look, this is a much bigger story than just about you and your family. And like, I'm here sending you these messages and maybe even sending you this comfort. Because this is the way that you can process this. Not that it's ever processed. Like, it's still going on.
Yeah, right. I mean, I'm not sure that strength is the right word, but it takes a huge amount of strength to, I mean, just put your feet on the floor in the morning. And you're talking about, you know, friends and neighbors who came around to learn with you or to speak with you or to just help you try and process if such a thing could ever happen. But your books have become a source of that inspiration, a source of that comfort for people either experiencing grief or experiencing other difficult challenges at that time. And even, you know, moving forward, how much have you looked, how much do you feel you've had to look inwards for that sort of strength? How much has it come from external sources? And you say that, you know, that God even sort of came afterwards, and you were sort of, as you said, you know, pushed into Emunah. What were those sources of strength and inspiration for you that has allowed you to become that for so many other people?
Yeah, that's a good question. First of all, I hate the word strength because I don't feel like I'm a strong person. It's just, I'm a person who has a love of life, let's say, but I don't consider myself strong. I have to say my husband was my main source of comfort because I really felt like we were one person when after this terrible murder, that we processed things together and that almost I felt like after Kobe was murdered, I had no defenses. And it was almost like I had no, all the barriers were down. So I was very vulnerable, but I was very connected to my husband and my children and the community. The community just protected us and nurtured us. It was almost like, you know, we were like fledglings in a nest and they took care of us. They literally fed us and did our laundry and kept us going. But what was the other part of the question?
I suppose how...
Oh, how...
Yeah, how did you translate that into becoming a source of strength? I mean, even if you see yourself, you may not see yourself as that source of comfort.
I think one thing, maybe because I didn't grow up religious and I grew up in a family that, not that they were so honest, but things were out in the open. And I think a lot of people are very afraid of expressing sadness or being not okay. And the fact that I was able to say, no, this is broke. You know, I'm a broken person and I am in chaos and I want to die. That is comforting to people who suffer tragedies because that whole idiom of like, be strong is just, it's not a comfort when you hear that. But one thing that did help me, I gave a ride to like a young, like a 14-year-old, and I was talking to him, and he said to me, guard your strength. He said in Hebrew, like, tishmor et hakoach shelach, but like, protect your strength. And that's what I think is almost a gift of trauma, if you have enough support, that you learn to protect yourself. And also, you're vulnerable, but like, I was also very open. I could say things to people that I would never say now. Like, I can't listen to that. This isn't good for me. Like, I had clarity. about what was good and what was bad. And I think maybe that's what helps other people. And also that I think it takes courage. I mean, it wasn't courageous for me. I was saving my life by writing this book. But I think other people see it as courageous because I exposed myself, my feelings. But the truth is that I had a journal that was much more raw than what I wrote. What I wrote was actually crafted. But it wasn't crafted because I had to write a narrative, even though that was part of it. It was like I received this story, and then it was almost like my responsibility to transmit it to the world.
Can I ask you about comfort? You mentioned the word a few times. Something I struggle with is, people say, I hope this brings you comfort. I think sometimes people don't necessarily, they're not quite sure what that means. When they're going through a difficult time, there's almost an expectation that at some point they will now feel comforted. And if we look at in terms of the Hebrew word, like nechama is often the word we use. Like, how do you understand nechama? How do you understand comfort? What can we do, as in what's someone who's going through a challenging time, what's the aim when they're looking to be comforted? What's the aim? Or for other people looking to comfort other people, what should we be doing to help them reach, feel nechama?
Yeah, I think comfort is really the ability to be present with somebody else when they're suffering. And, I trained in this too. Afterwards, I became a pastoral counselor. But being present means that you're not trying to fix it. You're not giving advice and you're not trying to solve it. You're just there with them. And I know during the Shiva, I could tell if somebody could comfort me or not. And some people, they said the same words, like, I have no words or something like that. And it depended on who they were. If I felt like they were saying, I can't handle this, this is too much for me, or I am with you, even though there's no language here. It was almost like I could feel them. So I think a person has to work on themselves to be able to, in order to comfort, not that you're comfortable with suffering, but that you can withstand another person's pain and just be there. And it's also like, I know pastoral counselors, lots of times they daven before they go into a room, like, God, give me the words, or tell me what to do with this person. Like, there's no formula. But, there were people who came to me that I just felt that they weren't afraid of what we had gone through. And they could hold it with me. Like, part of my relationship with my husband at that time, it was like, I felt like we were holding this terrible suitcase of grief, like 1,000 pounds of it, lugging it. And when somebody comes to you and they can also hold it with you, it's like, it's not that you're comforted, because it's true, like, only God can send you comfort. But there's a lightening, like, you're not alone. You're not alone with it, even though you are alone. But it's the feeling of isolation that can hurt a person. And when you break that isolation, then it's almost like the comfort is a gift, because it's almost like the barriers between two people dissolve. And usually there's very clear barriers between people. But I know when I was so broken that when somebody came and could hold it with me, it was like we became more like one person.
The books are a source of that for other people, that the people experiencing grief or challenges, whatever they may be, from afar can feel that there is someone else there with them. And I think the books are going to do that. Harry and I were saying that, when the book came out in 2003, we were teenagers in the UK, and it was an important, as we knew it was important at the time. Ari and I, we're not, we're around the same age as Kobe. And, that you have, whether it was on purpose or not, you've become that person who lets the world know that there is always someone around who can be that source of comfort. And is that what led to sort of the Kobe Mandel Foundation and Comedy for Kobe and these other initiatives that you've sort of spearheaded? Is that are they part of the same thinking as the behind the books, as, you know, providing yourself with some sort of process, but also being there for others?
Yeah, I think, but I think I was like more selfish about it, that I needed to be with people who were broken. And also I felt like with Camp Kobe, for example, you know, it's my husband really established the foundation and I'm like a co-founder, but we saw what was going on with our kids. We were like our own focus group. And there was like, there were people for our children, but they didn't want to go to them. They didn't want to necessarily go to a therapist. And we understood that they needed a place where they would feel understood and be with other kids who were in a similar situation. And yeah, we did want to help other people. Like, I was in a place where the only people I could connect to were other bereaved mothers or friends who were therapists or grief counselors or just, you know, good neshamot, like very, very, you know, I think what happens is we received so much kindness that it was almost natural to pass that kindness on. So for example, the first project we did was a woman's healing retreat. But I brought my friends who had helped me because they were therapists and massage therapists and just everybody who had done kindness. So some of those people became the staff for the first women's healing retreat. And we're still running those retreats. And the camp also we've been doing for 20 summers. We just had a camp over Hanukkah. And it is true that the kids feel differently when they're in a place where they feel safe to talk about what happened to them, who they lost, because you feel, it's like what I was saying before, you feel it, if you're in a safe place where people can receive this story. But usually you have to hide it, especially a child, because their friends can't understand what happened to them, and they may not want to go to a psychologist. And like just at the camp we just did, we also had a family day. And so many of the parents, mostly mothers, they said, I understand, like one, her husband had just died, and like 3 months earlier. And she said her child will not talk about it. But she said that the counselor here told her that the child was talking about it. And the child told her also. It's like they can open up in those places. So it's like creating a community. And I think maybe that's what we're talking about in terms of comfort and the books, that in a way, I hate to say inadvertently, because, you know, it'd be nice to take credit for all this, but it's like I inadvertently created a community. I mean, now I'm happy about it, that I can offer comfort, but my main goal was to survive and to like find a way to offer comfort to myself and my children. And everything the foundation did was because we also needed it. But the work, I think, now that it's been going on for 20 years, we have like a generation of kids now who are more fluent emotionally. Like they have more emotional intelligence because they went to Camp Kobe. So even though these kids a lot of times could be called, you know, traumatized children, like our goal was always to make them into leaders, because we felt like if you can take this pain, because pain is power, and lots of times the pain can be used against oneself, but if it can be expressed in the world, then you can do great things. And just to mention, like our daughter, Eliana, she's taking over the foundation now, and she went to Camp Kobe. And she was a camper and a counselor and a division head. And then she worked for us. And now she's going to run the foundation. So we see that, and we see it with a lot of the kids that come back to camp, that they're, you know, they're thriving. It didn't destroy them. Because what we learned was that a lot of psychiatric hospitalizations are due to unprocessed grief. Like grief is a very... can be a very powerful demon or angel. I don't know if it's an angel, but it can push you you know, like that's the road to resilience. It right. can just push you to do things that are greater than are really possible for you. Because I would say to myself, like, what am I afraid of? I you know, I face such a hard thing, like speaking in Hebrew to 15,000 people, even though I can hardly speak Hebrew, like I had to do on one Yom HaZikaron. Like, I could do it because of will. And my husband always says that what pushed him in terms of creating this foundation and keeping it running, you know, through a recession and through COVID and through lots of setbacks was just pure will. Like, we wanted people to remember Kobe, and we wanted to express Kobe's power in the world. And also, we felt like Kobe's body was dead, but we were going to keep his spirit alive. And he loved to have fun, and he loved to laugh, and he loved also helping people. And he loved the fact that we had moved to Israel. He loved being Israeli.
So looking at all of that, and maybe talking now about perhaps the next exciting stage of things, stage, no pun intended. so Blessing of Broken Heart is now being adapted into a play, which is going to be touring around Israel, which we'll give details for in the show notes of the episode. But can you tell us a bit about that process of taking your book that was there sort of writing on words and turning that into a play to be performed on stage?
Yeah, well, first of all, the play was already done in America. There's somebody, a professor of theater at the University of California at San Diego. His name is Todd Salovey. And he happened to read the book, and he decided that he wanted to make the book into a play, that he thought it would be a very powerful piece of theater. And so he adapted the book into a screenplay. Not a screenplay. What's it called? A script. He adapted the book into a script. And then he and I worked together. We added some other essays that I had written and other episodes from my life to sort of balance out the book a little bit. And it toured around America a little bit, the play. And now we decided to do it in Israel. And Yael Valier from Efrat, she has a theater company called Theater and Theology. So she is directing the play, and it's going to be put on stage next month. But, you know, I have very mixed feelings about it. Like, I'm very happy. When Todd took the book and made it into a play, I felt like he was taking some of the burden off of my shoulders, some of the grief, like some of the story. Because like in narrative therapy, they say that part of the power of narrative therapy is telling the story, but then having somebody witness the story. And he was creating this vehicle for people to actually witness the story. And when I saw the actress in the play, I felt like she was more me than me, because I can't put the emotion anymore into the story because it's too painful for me and it's not healthy for me. But she could put all the emotion back. And that's what the actress is going to do here as well. And the fact that it's going to be shown in Israel is very meaningful for me because, you know, we went through an intifada here. It's not just my story. It's a story of what happened during the intifada. And I think it's a story of like Jewish courage and resilience and finding a way to connect with figures from the Torah or from the Talmud, like Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, in a way that can be a comfort, like not just to me, but to other people as well, because it uses like the Torah, that's the vocabulary in a way of some of this play.
You describe yourself as a person who loves life, and that Kobe is someone who also loved life, loves to laugh. And then, so I mean, the other thing is that we have to talk about is comedy for Kobe, where a few times a year, comedians, usually from the US, are brought over to Israel. They tour around, do some shows. It's a wonderful night out. How have you found that to be sort of an integral part of processing the story or finding that love of life again.
Yeah, well, comedy for Kobe is a gift to us because Avi Lieberman, who runs the comedy shows and is a comedian himself, he came to us. He needed a charity for this comedy show. And he had asked a bunch of charities, and they all said no for various reasons. And we said yes right away. And the fact that we're involved in comedy, and like we've been doing it, I think, for almost 10 years, twice a year, means that now when people come up to us, like let's say we're in the airport, and somebody comes up and says, oh, hi, I know you. Oh, yeah. And they talk about how funny the comedians were or what great jokes it was. It was like it transformed us from symbols of pain or maybe like transformation to symbols of fun and happiness, which is really incredible when you think about it. Because, you know, we suffered such a terrible tragedy and we were so broken. And to be able to symbolize happiness, and not just for us, but like for the whole English-speaking population of Israel. Like every English-speaking person almost in Israel knows about comedy for Kobe. Yeah. And Kobe would love it because Kobe he was really funny and we would laugh a lot. And, you know, he was murdered in 2001. It was like the internet was not very big then. But he had a list of jokes that he had taken from the internet. Like that was, he and Yosef, he was murdered with Yosef Yishran, and he and Yosef both shared like that love of jokes and laughing.
In terms of that, I mean, the key words that you said you've been thinking about it more recently in terms of your teaching, in terms of happiness. So how does that, I guess, almost as maybe a final question, thinking about how does happiness play into your story, finding happiness, you know, what happiness means, how do you relate to it?
My mother, she always said to me, the best vengeance is a good life. So she wasn't religious. She didn't go to synagogue or she didn't connect to Israel. But I feel like some wisdom got passed down in my mother. Like she really taught me a lot, and my father, and my family. And there's just something in us that just loved to laugh all the time and to have fun. And I think because that I was brought up like the most important thing was to have fun. And when that's your goal, then you find a lot of happiness. And I think, you know, Bli Ayin Hara, I was blessed with that ability to find joy and to do, like now especially, to like do things that I enjoy. And that, you know, sometimes God blesses you with the ability to rise from like the ashes. And I think all of Israel were like that, you know, like we're the 11th happiest country in the world. And when people outside of Israel hear about Israel, they think that it's all terror and war. And of course, we have a lot of challenges. But when you walk around Israel and you see the people, a lot of times they're really happy people. I mean, they're also fighting with each other and yelling at each other.
They're happy doing it. That's what
That's what brings them joy.
They're happy connecting. There's such a strong connection and there's such a strong emphasis on family that I think the main thing maybe that gives happiness is connection, you know, where you feel like you belong. And I think that's what Israel gives us, is that just strong feeling of belonging.
So a question I wanted to ask before, which I forgot to ask, but maybe you'll add it in earlier. I'll ask now.
We can just put this as the final question. Yeah,
I know this is not really a final question. It's more earlier you talked about the idea of language and how you found Tefillah and Tehillim gave you that language. And the title of your first book obviously is The Blessing of Broken Heart. I wanted to ask how you understand that word blessing. And when we talk about in the text, in the Talmud, we talk about we should bless God for the good and for the bad. Baruch Atah Hamet, Baruch Hatov Ametiv. What is that? What is a blessing? And what does it mean to bless God for something, whether it's good or bad?
I think it's, you know, we just read the story of Yosef. And when the brothers go to Yosef and they're afraid he's going to be so angry with them, And Yosef says something like, you know, you thought, what does he say? You thought this was for the bad, but God meant it for the good.
There just happens to have been a Karin Steinsaltz chumash on the table in front of Sherry when we got
it's
here.
It's true. Wait, I got to get my glasses. It is a great chumash. Yeah, here it is. You intended me harm. God intended it for good in order to engender as it is today, to keep many people alive. Like, in other words, what you think is so terrible, and it is terrible. Like, I will never say that that my son's murder was good, even though good things came out of it. But I feel like the story of Yaakov and Yosef is the story of what will be at the end of days, that when we experienced everything as so painful in the next world, we'll see, no, it was meant for the good. But in this world, we could only experience it as pain. Because even Yaakov, in this week's Parsha, Ve'achi, you know, he tries to tell his children what will be at the end of days, and even his prophecy is diminished. So it's just that in this world, we can't know. And, like, I think a lot of people, they turn away from religion because it's just their experience is too painful. And it's like, how can there be a God who forces this much pain on people? But, you know, and I understand that because I felt after Kobe's murder that I really couldn't take the pain. But because I had this friend, Shira, who was a grief counselor, and I had my family, and I had my husband, like, I could bear it. I could hold. There was a way that I could just find a way to live with it, even though every day I felt like I can't do this. So when people feel that severity of pain, it's like, how can there be a God who's allowing this? And so for me, the only way that I could make sense of this world is to understand, no, this world is just a part of the world. Like, it's this, you know, it's what we believe in Judaism, that there is a world to come. There's something greater than this, because if this is it, this is not enough.
I think, I mean, we'll end there. I think that understanding certainly comes through in your book. You said you don't like the word strength and or courage or whatever, but I as an observer, you know, those are the words. Resilience is the word. As in, you do just embody resilience, and the fact that you're able to recognize the blessing of a broken heart and relay that to others, be it in writing, on stage, through comedy shows, through a summer camp, through whatever it is, even this conversation, I think is something incredibly special. I'm very grateful. I'm going to speak on Nari's behalf now that you've allowed us into your home and given us your time and spoken to us so candidly and openly about everything. And that you do serve as this sort of as source of inspiration and comfort and resilience for so many people, and you should be able to do so for many more years to come. I'm at a loss of words. I'm sitting here and I've been nodding along the whole time that, you know, I'm very, very grateful and that you're able to recognize and to come through such pain and to translate that into something so positive is hugely inspirational. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Sherry. Thanks so much. That's all the time we have for this episode. It really was amazing to meet Sherry and to speak with her about her experiences. And personally, I just learned so much and was really inspired by just what she shared with us.
Yeah. Make sure to check out the amazing work being done by the Kobe Mandel Foundation on their website, kobemandel.org. where you'll also find information about Comedy for Kobe. The stage production of The Blessing of a Broken Heart is about to start touring Israel. You can find information at theatreandtheology.com for shows in Jerusalem, Modi'in, Ra'anana, Beit Shemesh, and The Gush. All of this information will be in the show notes.
If you'd like to contact us, you can reach us on social media at Corin Publishers or via email podcast@corinpub.com.
And you can get 10% off Sherry's books, The Blessing of a Broken Heart and The Road to Resilience, and all other titles exclusively at www.corinpub.com with code PODCAST at checkout.
Finally, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the Corin podcast wherever you're listening, and make sure to share it with at least two friends. We've been blown away with all of your feedback and kind comments about the podcast, so let's make sure to get everyone listening.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of the Corin podcast.
Until next time.